Good afternoon. My name's Jennifer Cook. I'm director of the Africa program here at CSIS, and I want to welcome you all to this panel today on the way forward on Sudan's comprehensive peace agreement. We have a terrific panel today to talk about the challenges ahead, how to move the process forward, and I think the agreement, which is facing particular challenges in these coming years, is at a critical moment. Just to start, I think the CPA was always understood to be a starting point in a long process. There were limitations to the agreement. I think these were acknowledged and recognized really from the very beginning that this was a limited agreement initially between the two belligerent parties to end what was at the time the hot conflict within Sudan between the SPLM and Khartoum. And it was understood that that was limited, but this was meant to be, as I said, a starting point and to tackle the larger problems of a transformation of Sudan. You needed to end that particular conflict first and then begin a process of political transformation. So the weaknesses, I think, and the limitations of the agreement were well understood at the very beginning. It was understood at the very beginning that this the process of transformation and implementation of the CPA would require a great deal of international stewardship, hand-holding, browbeating, and pushing both parties to live up to the commitments they made within the CPA. And arduous as the process was and as detailed as the final agreement was, I think much of the vision within the CPA was held in the minds of some of the principal negotiators, most notably John Garang and Taha. And I think with the passing of John Garang, there was lost a great deal of the vision for the ultimate implementation of the CPA. Part of what we're going to hear today, I think, is an assessment of where we stand in the implementation process of this, what the looming challenges are, and now as we stand at the beginning of a new administration here in the United States, what are the critical issues that this next administration is going to have to pick up. A perfect implementation of the CPA is very unlikely, or a complete implementation of the CPA. But what are those critical red lines that must be followed through? And what are the greatest threats, and how can we preempt or mitigate those threats to the CPA? So let me introduce the panel. You have their bios, so I won't go into great detail, but we're very pleased to have Sir Derek Plumley here, who's come just for this event a very long way. Sir Derek is chair of the Sudan Assessment and Evaluation Commission since 2008. So he's fairly new to the CPA process, but not new to the region at all. He was UK ambassador to Egypt and to Saudi Arabia, and he's been director of the Middle East and North Africa at the UK Foreign Office. He is highly respected within the British FCO, as I've heard from many of his colleagues, and we're delighted to have him here. We're also using this occasion to highlight and profile the launch of a Chatham House report, which was authored by Dr. Edward Thomas, who's with us today. The report called Against the Gathering Storm, Securing Sudan's Comprehensive Peace Agreement. I think there are a number of copies available, and I'm sure you can find information on how to get more on the Chatham House website as well. Eddie has spent a long time in Sudan since the mid-'80s. He was a teacher in northern Sudan. He's worked with Sudanese refugee groups, and he'll talk a little bit about the methodology and the recommendations of his most recent report. Next, we have Ambassador Andrew Natsios. I think most of you who know he is today on the faculty of the Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. And he was, most relevant here, special envoy to Sudan from December 06 to September 07, where he worked indefatigably on very complicated and often frustrating circumstances. He was also the administrator of USAID and formerly served as director of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. again, his bio's here. He has many more accomplishments that I won't go into. And then Alex Duvall, who is a great friend of CSIS. He's program director at the Social Science Research Council in New York. He's been engaged on Sudan and on Darfur in particular probably longer than most people in this room. He's been a director of Justice Africa in London, and he's been a tireless advocate and analyst for the way forward in Sudan. So with that, I will turn to Cedric Plumley, and we'll then who will give the keynote. We'll then have presentations and open it as quickly as we can for question and answers from the audience.
Well, Jennifer, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to update on the CPA, and for giving me the opportunity to come to Washington as well. It's much appreciated. Thank you. I think the meeting is timely, not just because of what's going on here in Washington and the impending change of administration, or indeed because of what may or may not happen in The Hague, but because it coincides almost exactly with the fourth anniversary of the signature of the CPA, which was marked in Malakal in southern Sudan last weekend, and thus with the beginning of the final and decisive 2 years of the six-year interim period set for CPA implementation in the agreement. And it sounds, it's a bit trite to say so, but the CPA, it's worth stating, I think, at the beginning, was a historic achievement in the sense that it ended Africa's longest-running civil war and the one which was possibly most costly in terms of loss of life and retarded development. And I'm very conscious of the weight of experience on the rest of the discussants on this panel and would defer to it, but particularly would commend to you Edward Thomas's report on securing Sudan's comprehensive peace agreement, which I think sets out the background and the way things have developed very clearly and very well. My own perspective is very much that of a diplomat who's tasked with protecting the CPA and helping as best I can and as best the commission I chair can to secure its effective implementation. The AEC, which gets a sort of somewhat modest write-up in Edward's report, brings together the parties, they sit in on everything, as full members, along with the governments which supported the signature, witnessed the signature of the CPA and supported the preceding negotiations, including, of course, the United States, and the international organizations which witnessed it, the African Union, the Arab League, the UN, and the EU. It's tasked with monitoring and supporting the agreement, and particularly producing a report at the midterm in CPA implementation, which was the point reached in July last year. And so to a certain extent, what I have to say now is drawn out of that report, because it is an agreed assessment by the parties and by the members of the Commission. But it also, what I say also reflects my own personal views of the way things have gone, and particularly so, of course, in respect of the last 6 months. The evaluation report noted that the CPA has been resilient in the sense that peace has been preserved between North and South, that the ceasefire has largely, I stress the word largely, but has largely held. The institutions of government provided for in it, and notable amongst these, of course, all those institutions in the South, the government of Southern Sudan, the autonomous government there, have been created and sustained, and revenue from oil produced in the South has been shared. And as a result of the agreement, some 2 million refugees and IDPs have been able to return to their homes in southern Sudan. Against that, mistrust has persisted, fed by delays, partial non-implementation of parts of the agreement. We could spend a lot of time attributing blame for that. In part, I think it's attributable to the complexity of the agreement, as Jennifer was pointing out. It was a very large task, really, to put in place all of the institutions and the and to pursue all of the provisions which are there in the various protocols of the agreement. But as a consequence of these delays, many of the elements in the sort of CPA structure, which one might have considered essential to the success of or success in achieving the objective of making unity attractive, a National Civil Service Commission, for example, or the National Committee on the Rights of Non-Muslims in the National Capital, or a program of national reconciliation and healing, or a Human Rights Commission. These have either been set up belatedly and not fully resourced, or, in the case of the Human Rights Commission, for example, haven't yet seen the light of day at all. Dissatisfaction with the progress achieved led the SPLM to suspend its participation in the Government of National Unity in 2007. They came back into government just over a year ago, and since they resumed participation, some significant milestones have been passed. The census, which is a CPA requirement, took place, albeit with southern reservations, in April and May of last year. The Oslo Donors Conference, a follow-up to the initial Oslo Conference 3 years on, was held in May too and was a success. There was fighting, serious fighting, of which you'll doubtless be aware, in Abyei just after that. But in the wake of it, the parties moved to draw up a roadmap with tight deadlines for the establishment of an interim arrangements in the area and provision for the underlying dispute to be taken to international arbitration. Legislation providing a framework for elections at all levels in Sudan in 2009, as provided for in the CPA, was adopted in July, and the National Electoral Commission was appointed after a further delay, but in November. So there was progress during the course of last year, but it was intermittent and at times painfully slow. What I'd like to focus on here now, I think, is just five specific subjects. I mean, the CPA is, as I said, complex, and all of the provisions interlock with each other, and lack of success in some is likely to impact other aspects of the agreement. But nonetheless, five areas which are crucial, I think, for there to be a chance of success in the coming 2 years. The five subject areas in question are the three areas, that is to say, Abyei, Southern Kordofan, and Blue Nile, which are subject to specific protocols of their own under the CPA. Border demarcation, security sector reform, developments in the security sector particularly, elections, and the 2011 referendum and what happens after it. With regard to Abyei, the highest profile of the three areas, the immediate priority is to ensure full implementation of the roadmap. It has proceeded, that implementation, more or less as agreed, but with deadlines which have slipped, against deadlines which have slipped seriously. The final step in SAF withdrawal from the Difra oil field has still to be taken, SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces. A shooting incident last month in Abyei between elements in the Joint Integrated Unit and the Joint Integrated Police Unit, I mean, the two units which have been put in place in to take over security from the withdrawing forces of the SAF and the SPLA, underlined their continued vulnerability, the continued vulnerability of these units, and the need for material support and training. The interim administration, which has been put in place, lacks a budget, and this is something which we in the AEC have been working on sort of rather closely in the last week or two to try to encourage administration and the government to get together and to agree what is needed. All of this needs to be put in place quickly if IDPs are to return, and if there is to be any sort of foundation in place at the point at which the Permanent Court of Arbitration reports in June. At that point, in preparation for that, in my view, it would be wise, really, for the parties actually to engage in discussion now on arrangements for the longer term to implement the IBA protocol, which would hold whatever is the result of the arbitration process. As in the case of IBA, volatility in Southern Kordofan could threaten the CPA. The AEC visited areas in the state in November, and we were made aware of the anger felt by many in the former SPLA-controlled areas in the Nuba Mountains, and indeed by others, including in majority Misaria areas, at neglect since the CPA was signed in 2005. Power sharing there has been tortuous, and aid and government funding inadequate. We heard differing assessments of the trend in security incidents, but all agreed that the state is awash with arms and the risk of violence real. There has been positive movement in the past 6 months in the shape of security agreements between the parties, which have resulted in the opening of the formerly SPLA-controlled areas, redeployment south by the SPLA units concerned, and moves to absorb and integrate the former SPLA police and civil service. But the fragility of the process was illustrated, if that were needed, in the past few days by an incident involving former SPLA elements, again in a JIU, and government paramilitaries. The SPLM in the state feel vulnerable and fear reinforcement of government forces. Confidence-building measures and funding in support of integration are essential if security and stability are to be achieved. UNMISS and the international community need to encourage and support the integration process. The second priority is demarcation of the north-south border, which is now more than 3 years overdue. We have been told repeatedly in the AEC by the parties that the report of the technical committee, which has been working on this, is almost ready. It's always almost ready for submission to the presidency. But when it is, work will then be needed. Work on presentation to ensure that demarcation is understood as disadvantaging nobody and that the border is open in every sense of the word. And I think to resolve remaining points of difference. It should be moved forward now. Further delay will prolong uncertainty and tension in disputed areas and impact CPA implementation across a wide range of issues, from redeployment to elections to the referendum. The third priority I mentioned relates to the security sector, and the issues here are, of course, various, and I haven't got time to go into all of them, but the persistence of mistrust between the parties is reflected in high defense expenditure and the concentration of forces in the border areas. The government in the south has another security challenge in the shape of the availability of arms there and is engaged both in efforts to disarm civilians and also to professionalize the SPLA. In the AEC, working collectively, we have homed in on really two issues. One is the need for support for the JIUs, which I've mentioned, which are important and which are starved of equipment, training, you name it, they don't have it. And the other priority is a major program of disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration as envisaged in the CPA. That program is now moving. If it were implemented in full, some 180,000 people and their communities would benefit. But wisely, I think UNMISS and the Northern and Southern DDR commissions have chosen to proceed in stages, starting with what looked like the areas of greatest vulnerability and volatility, specifically Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan, two of the three areas that I mentioned earlier. And we have been working with UNMISS to try to resolve donor questions about this, and just last week, the Japanese came forward with the first major pledge for the DDR program. Successful handling of these three priorities, which in itself is a major challenge, that's to say the three areas, border demarcation and security issues, is essential if the CPA is to move forward successfully over the next 2 years and a return to violence avoided. Getting the remaining ones, elections and preparations for 2011, right, will determine the future of Sudan. Under the CPA, the constitution and the electoral law, elections should be held before July 2009. Taking the rainy season into account, this could mean they're having to be held in the next 4 months. The parties are working on bringing relevant legislation, the press and security laws primarily, into line with the CPA, and the National Electoral Commission is working with urgency on issues related to its own organization and funding. But preparations have yet to begin for a new electoral register, for any sort of public awareness campaign, and for the drawing up of constituency boundaries, which, of course, would be dependent both on the demarcation of the border, which hasn't yet taken place, and, in theory at least, on census results, which are still to be announced and likely to be controversial. There's also the issue of how Darfur should be represented when the election takes place. The task of identifying feasible dates in 2009 lies fairly and squarely with the National Electoral Commission and the parties. And I don't think that any of the problems I've mentioned, though large, are insuperable. Successful elections are central to the democratic transformation envisaged in the CPA and arguably offer the best prospect of making unity attractive. But they will need careful preparation and international support, both in terms of technical and financial assistance and monitoring when they take place. The fifth and final priority area to which I'd like to draw attention is the need to begin now to prepare for 2011. The CPA envisaged passage in the third year of the interim period of the legislation needed to make arrangements for the referendum which will enable the people of southern Sudan to exercise their right of self-determination. The right and the referendum itself lie at the heart of the CPA. The parties are now agreed to try, at least, to finalize the referendum law before the present assembly is dissolved, the present National Assembly is dissolved, i.e. before the preparations for the elections take off. If that were to be achieved, it would be, I think, an important reassurance to the southerners who feel that they may lose their blocking minority in the next assembly, possibly as a result of the census. There is a second aspect to this, that is to say, to the preparations for the referendum in 2011. The AEC's remit is to help make unity attractive. But anybody who spent any length of time in the south of Sudan recently will know that the possibility of a vote for secession is real. Equally, however, the fundamental interdependence of North and South Sudan is self-evident, as is the need for both to continue to work together in peace. I think probably on this issue, the best thing to do is actually to repeat the message that we agreed in the midterm evaluation as regards the importance of the parties using the remainder of the interim period to discuss and develop links and arrangements across the political, economic, energy, and security fields, which look beyond 2011 and will hold whatever the outcome of the referendum. The mutual interest in a long-term wealth-sharing deal in particular is obvious, given the extent of interdependence in the sector and the degree of reliance both of the government in Khartoum, the government of national unity, and the government of southern Sudan on oil income. Discreetly encouraging dialogue on this is amongst the most important things the international community can do in the remainder of the interim period. Other deadlines in CPA implementation have slipped, but 2011 is one which, given the nature of the agreement, and the strength of a sentiment cannot. At the fourth anniversary celebration event in Malakal, both President Bashir and First Vice President Salva Kiir, from their different perspectives, concentrated on the narrowing window, with the President reaffirming the commitment to self-determination, but also setting out steps, a committee on a program of national reconciliation, development projects along the border and in the south, designed to make unity attractive. We could talk at length about the forces at work within the parties, but my belief is that both in their different ways are concerned to stick with the CPA through the remaining 2 years of the interim period. For all the mistrust, they need each other. But the agenda is dauntingly full, both of outstanding business. Notably, I think I would highlight, talking of red lines, the Abyei arbitration and its successful handling, and border demarcation. And also full of a concentration of transformational events, elections at all levels, from the presidential down to the State Assembly, popular consultation in Blue Nile and Southern Kordofan provided for in their protocols with regard to the future of governance in the states, and the referendum in Abyei, as well as that in the south itself. And all of these will require careful management. They're also going to require a degree of international backing and support. Indeed, I think you could say, I mean, the process of negotiating the CPA was achieved with strong international support and a strong international presence. The need for coordinated international facilitation and encouragement will be at its greatest in the 2 years that are upcoming. UNMISS, which is the sort of physical presence, physical manifestation of the international community on the ground, will be called on to take on new roles in support of elections, along the border perhaps, if and when demarcation takes place. I think it's worth asking, will doubtless come up in discussion, how the activity of the International Criminal Court affects all of this. The answer must be that it depends in significant part on the governments and organizations who gather every month, almost every week, actually, in different formats, around the AEC table, including the United States, including also both the movements which are represented in the government in the north and in the south of Sudan. All may come under pressure to react to developments in ways which are unlikely to advance the accountability agenda, but could undermine opportunities for cooperation in support of the CPA. And it will, in my view, be important for the members of the international community most concerned, whatever happens, to find ways to signal their determination to stay engaged with both parties in support of development and security in the south, in the war-affected areas, and in support of the broader purposes of the CPA. Early appointment of a special envoy here with that sort of mandate, but we would be one such signal. I hope that a key message that people will take away from this meeting will be one of the centrality of the CPA itself to peace in Sudan. Without peace between north and south, there could be no prospect of peace in the country more generally. As Edward Thomas' paper makes clear, the CPA provides the framework within which the aspirations of other regions and parties in Sudan can be realized. Decentralization, the constitution, and the specific possibilities opened up by elections this year. Some of the CPA institutions in waiting, the Human Rights Commission or the National Land Commission, for example, could, I am sure, be crafted in such a way as to address imperatives in other peace processes. The SPLM, along with others in Sudan, needs to be enabled to play its part in the search for peace in Sudan. But I will just end on one note of caution, and that is that it would, in my view, be rash in the extreme to think, in the context of an all-Sudan approach, which I agree is right, of reopening the CPA in order to accommodate the approach. Peace between north and south and the opportunities it has opened up in the South and the areas affected by the Civil War remains an enormous prize. The agreement may not have been implemented fully, as Jennifer said, but or as its authors intended, but the balance within it remains very delicate, and this late stage is not the moment at which to reopen it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jennifer, and thank you, Sir Derek, for setting the scene so clearly and giving such an excellent explanation of the achievements and the challenges ahead. I'd like to concur wholeheartedly with what you were saying about the importance of the CPA. It's a far-sighted and thoughtful agreement which has addressed Sudan's big problem, unequal development and mismanaged diversity, through a set of processes and institutions, very complex set of processes and institutions, to share wealth and power more fairly across Sudan. And I think those are an unavoidable set of principles for peace in Sudan. The CPA has flaws, and both of our first speakers have indicated some of them. But I want to again concur with Sir Derek in saying that the CPA's flaws do not mean in any way that it should be renegotiated. The paper that I've written is not a call to rework the CPA, but to try and make it work between the boundary within the boundaries of Sudan's political realities. And the report also tries to set out what those realities are. A deeply coercive and unequal relationship between a powerful centre and a weak and poor periphery. It also tries to look at how that reality might change. Coercive politics may have reached the limit of their utility in Sudan, and the current heavy external pressures on the country may help to force a rethink at the centre. I guess most of you know about the CPA's limitations as a text, a bilateral deal that has given about 80% of power, measured in official positions, to the two parties that signed it. It may have created precedents for other military groups to emerge and to aim for other bilateral agreements. Another problem, perhaps, with the way that it's constructed is that it granted the right of self-determination to some, but not to all citizens, giving southern citizens that right less of an incentive to work to transform the deeply unequal relationship between the centre and the periphery that I mentioned before. Nevertheless, the CPA's minimum operating conditions, minimum operating requirements have all been put in place. They were all put in place in a burst of energy and commitment in the first 6 or 12 months of the agreement back in 2005. These minimum operating requirements, so to speak, are to do with the functioning of the central state, setting up and funding state institutions in Juba, changing the composition of the government at the centre to include more southerners. But one of the disappointments has been the limited nature of tangible change in ordinary life. Ambitious proposals to change land systems, invest in local services in the periphery of Sudan, work for national reconciliation, and some kind of agreed sense of what it means to be Sudanese, all those have been shelved. The agreement can operate without ending the war in Darfur or preventing the emergence of new conflicts elsewhere. Without ambitious policies to end these conflicts, a united Sudan is no longer so attractive for southerners. But the CPA's agreed principles for sharing wealth and power could still help transform the troubled relationship between the centre and the periphery. This relationship needs help, not least because the National Congress Party, the governing parties, its revolutionaries have so long aggravated the contradictions within the peripheries to mobilise for war in the south and in Darfur and elsewhere. At the centre, too, the NCP swept away traditional parties that had managed the neglected margins without too much violence and had given northern Sudan a kind of cultural coherence that has been replaced today with embattled, often violent, ethnically constructed regional groupings. The diversities and the contradictions of Sudan, including those of northern Sudan, are leading towards fragmentation. And that's why I tried to argue that coercive politics, that this may be a positive thing in its, or it may contain the some hope for the future. Coercive politics probably won't work much longer in Sudan, and there may have to be a move towards more accommodating politics at the centre and more gains for the periphery. And again, the CPA's institutions and processes, including importantly the elections, are very important in achieving this. But because the CPA isn't delivering comprehensive peace across the country, because not enough attention is paid to the ambitious tasks of transforming the Sudanese state and addressing the impoverishment of many of its citizens, southern citizens are more focused on their opt-out than on the CPA. So the possibilities for political change may be shifting towards the National Congress Party, and it may now set the limits of political possibility in Sudan, the limits in which things can be done, can be changed. Is there a way to arrest fragmentation? Well, I think some of the comments that Sir Derek made about the importance of well-managed elections and referendums and sticking to the CPA timetable are a very important component of keeping Sudan from falling apart. But I think if the situation in Darfur is also to be to enjoy the solution, the ambitious parts of the agreement, those that call for land reform, reconciliation, distribution of wealth, of the wealth of the centre to the periphery, the kind of local government structures that can deliver services and development for ordinary people in rural and urban Sudan, they also need to be addressed. These are all key components of a settlement in Darfur, and we all know that. We also know that many of the institutions needed to bring them about to achieve this, they're set out, they're agreed in the CPA. But many Sudanese and foreign officials feel exhausted by the very fast tempo that the CPA requires, and they're put off by the ambitiousness of the agreement. Without tangible changes, I think another trend will emerge and dominate. That is to say, the regionalization or localization of politics in Sudan. Local actors, often armed, often using ethnicity as a recruiting sergeant, and politically very immature, will start, or perhaps have started, to offer more political promise to impoverished ordinary people than the two CPA partners. There is an important tradition of parliamentary politics in Sudan, but the old traditional parliamentary parties who used to run rural Sudan and kept northern Sudan in particular as a coherent political unit for much of the 20th century do not have the financial resources anymore and do not have the local influence to resolve the massive problems that are emerging there in this volatile post-conflict period on the southern borderlands and the volatile situation in Darfur as well. And for that reason, I'm not sure if the elections, which are required for this year, will be able to air the local and national critiques and disappointments with the agreement or allow civil actors to take part in politics to a sufficient extent. CPA processes seem to be becoming less important. Too much attention now is being paid to the referendum, and remember that the referendum will just reframe rather than resolving the fundamental problems of Sudan, and in particular it will leave peripheral northern Sudan, including Darfur, more embattled than it was before. So that's perhaps a rather somber set of conclusions about Sudan. I still think that the CPA is very important, and I still think that the international community has an extremely important role in addressing in helping Sudanese to make the best of the opportunities that still remain for them in the in the 2 years remaining, the 30 months remaining of the CPA. I think Sudan still has an opportunity to make itself work. The coming clutch of problems that were enumerated by in Sir Derek's presentation may well overwhelm it. But at the same time, this may be a moment like 2001, when the NCP, under intense international pressure, facing internal divisions, came to a decision of astonishing pragmatism to explore the possibility of an alliance with its bitterest foe, the SPLM, in order to prolong its grip on power. The NCP has once again reached the limits of coercive politics, I think, and in order to survive, it could make another deal. It could arrest fragmentation, and internationals, I think, have an important role in pushing the NCP to identify its interests with the wealth and power-sharing prescriptions of the CPA, which are, in my view, the alternative to fragmentation in Sudan. Another thing, I think, is that Sudan policy should be a bit more thoughtful. There seems to be a spectrum between NCP accommodation and regime change. I don't think regime change is a possibility. I don't think there's a Kitchener waiting in Egypt or Chad at the moment, and there's not likely to be one. And I don't think this policy spectrum makes sense because, as I say, one of the big emerging changes in Sudan is the regionalization or localization of politics, the embattled little armed groups that can end up as bandits or terrorists or Janjaweed or liberation soldiers. I think the fact that Sudan's traditional politics, its parliamentary politics, has been more or less eviscerated by the brilliant tactics of the NCP means that these local groups have become more important, too important perhaps, and internationals have a very important role in helping them unify and helping them get political. The only realistic political alternative to conflict right now in Sudan is fairer wealth and power sharing. And the CPA does offer an attractive set of possibilities for working those things out in rural Sudan. The next year, I think, the politics in Sudan will be dominated by the NCP's search for domestic allies. And I think the international community should watch the deals that the NCP is making with those allies and help those deals be productive ones for Sudan, help them be ones that orient Sudan towards a fairer kind of system for its people. Finally, I think ambition is important when you're dealing with Sudan. It's a very, very... It's an enormous country. It's a wonderful country, really. And it's come up with this amazing agreement, which really would transform Sudan and the Horn of Africa if it managed to work. But it's sometimes disappointing to listen to officials write off things like land reform or free and fair elections or national reconciliation as overly ambitious tasks. There won't be any peace in Darfur without progress on these issues. And I think that the international or Sudanese officials who complain that the CPA is too ambitious are wrong. It's the project of peace in Sudan that is so ambitious, because Sudan is such an unstable giant of a place with so much to get wrong or to get right. So thank you.
Thank you, Eddie. Ambassador Natsios.
Alex and I have less time, so I'm going to sort of summarize my comments. I wrote an article in May and June, the May and June issue of Foreign Affairs. It did cause a little stir when I wrote it. Some people got quite upset with me. But I think as time has progressed, my views not only have not changed, they've become stronger. And just after I wrote the article, the incident where the 2,000 Darfuri rebels came within the outskirts of the city in Omdurman took place, which only underscored my argument that there is a high risk of a dissolution of the country. And I do not mean the north separating from the south. I mean Sudan looking like Somalia or like the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It would be indeed odd, and I think it is a possibility, that if that took place, the only functioning part of the country might be the south. One thing I agree with Dr. Thomas and certainly with Sir Derek on is that's in his report, in Dr. Thomas's report, is that the forces, the centrifugal forces pulling the country apart, are causing the potential dissolution, in particular, of the North. But the South is actually becoming more unified in some very unusual ways that I could not have predicted 19 years ago when I first went there. Because 19 years ago, no one had any sense of being a Southerner. You were a Dinka, you were a Nuer, you were whatever the tribe was in the South. And there was more division among the Southerners than there certainly was toward the North. So I think the risk of dissolution is very high. I think this goes beyond the CPA. But if the CPA fails, if the North and the South go back to war, the dissolution of the country will accelerate at an extremely rapid rate. I don't think we're going to have a prolonged war like we did prior to the CPA. It will be rapid. I believe it will be extremely bloody. I think the risk of retributive violence on a mass scale of both Northerners and Southerners is very high. It almost happened in October. I think I've said this a couple of times before publicly, but I want to repeat. It almost happened in October and November of 07 while I was envoy. I was watching it unfold with great alarm because the United States was focused on Darfur, not on what was happening in the North and South. I think there's been a more equilibrium in the United States and in Western Europe on focusing on the North-South agreement as, in fact, in my view, more important than the solution to Darfur. And the reason I say that, not because Darfur is in a very sad situation, but the balkanization of the rebel groups in Darfur is so extreme at this point. Some of it encouraged, I might add, by the tactics of the NCP in trying to pick off different groups and divide them further. But we know from historical evidence in other civil wars that the longer a civil war goes on, and that's what Darfur is, the more, without a centralizing force, the more balkanization takes place, atomization of the groups. There are dozens of independent groups in Darfur at this point. And until there's essentially one person negotiating a peace agreement in Darfur, it's going to be very hard to get any kind of an agreement, very sadly. The government will manipulate all of the sides if there isn't one person negotiating. If Garang hadn't negotiated the North-South agreement, there'd be no CPA. If you had 100 groups in the South or even a dozen groups in the South negotiating with the North, we would never have had a solution to the conflict. I think we should, instead of focusing on everything, because this is what happens in every peace process I've been involved in, every reconstruction process, we tend to focus on too many things, we do too many things, and as a result, nothing gets done fully. There are two or three things that if they are not done and done well in the next 3 years are going to lead to the dissolution of the country. The first is the focus on the three areas. They are the most explosive areas because if the South separates, and I should say this, the likelihood of the mass of people in southern Sudan voting for unity is virtually non-existent. If every religious leader in the South, if every tribal leader, every traditional leader, if everybody in the SPLA who is an officer, everybody in the parliament, everybody in the executive branch said vote for unity, they won't vote for unity. That's my assessment. I traveled for several weeks the summer of 07. I talked to people. I've been going to Sudan for southern Sudan for 20 years. They are fed up with the North. And I have to say, for the first time, I began to hear in the summer of 07, Northerners fed up with the South, saying good riddance. I never heard a Northerner say that until the summer of 07. And I don't really think that's changed that much. The current comments that the NCP is making that we need to make unity attractive is not what they're saying privately. They're saying that publicly, I think, for tactical reasons that they want to deal on oil because they're worried about what will happen to the North if 2011 comes about and that's not dealt with. So the three areas have to be dealt with. There are issues in Blue Nile, in Abyei, and in Nuba. I'm not going to go through them all, but if they are not resolved prior to 2011, there is a high likelihood that will result in the dissolution of the country. Because those areas, two of those areas, are going to remain in the North, potentially one way or the other. Abyei, there's a referendum on it, but the whole process for a referendum requires a level of stability that they don't have right now. And the second thing that has to happen, and I might add, there is a potential solution that, again, is in the report Dr. Thomas presented, which is, it's not simple to implement, but it's not a very complex idea, which is exchange land for oil. The North may say many things. The thing they really care about in Abyei is the only large deposit in oil that they know exists in anything that could be considered the North. If the South gave a portion, substantial portion, of the oil revenues until those oil fields are depleted to the North in exchange for the Southerners getting the land back, I think a deal could be reached. It would take a lot of work and a lot of aggressive work to do it, but it would take into consideration the interests of both sides. And that's the one thing I think we make a mistake on. The chances of outside actors forcing people in Sudan to do things which they not only suspect but know are against their own interests is very, very unlikely. People don't normally take a weapon and blow their heads off. And that's what people from the West go in all the time, in the UN and the AU, and they tell Sudanese to do things that are basically suicidal. Then they don't accept what we tell them to do, and we get all upset. I sit there at these meetings. I carry my instructions out, and we all have these unified positions, and I'm just astonished that we're so naive to think that anybody, including the rebels in Darfur, the Southerners, are going to agree to things, or the North, or the Nile River Arabs, are going to agree to things that are essentially against their own interests from their own perspective. And most people in Sudan do not need to be lectured on what their interests are. They already know them. There are peace conferences I've been to where the participants are not sure what their interests are, and helping them to clarify that is useful. I don't think that's the case in Sudan, in any area of the country. The second thing that has to happen, in my view, is to deal with the issues that would take place if the South separates after 2011. Those issues must be settled before the referendum, because if they're not settled, the likelihood that one or more parties will want to stop the whatever the referendum says from going to effect is very, very high. And that is where there could be a flashpoint that could lead to war. So I think resolving the issue of oil revenues, for example, is a major issue. The oil has to go through, at this point, through Port Sudan to get out of the country. That's where the pipelines go. That's where the oil refineries are. Dealing with that as an issue comprehensively in the context of the three areas, in the context of North-South relations, I think could help stabilize the situation. If they're seriously talking and negotiating about these issues and there's some hope they can be resolved, then people will move toward a political solution rather than a military solution to the pressures and centrifugal forces on the country. I think it's also a mistake just to deal with the North-South issue, just as I thought it was a mistake for us to focus on Darfur alone. Alex, you know, and I debated some of these issues before. I think Alex argued, even before I was envoy, that we need a general political solution to some of the divisive issues in the South because, and there's a very big because, the Southerners and the Northerners never do anything in isolation. They always look at what else is happening in the country. Garang used to talk constantly about what was happening in the East in the Red Sea Hills. In Red Sea Province, what was happening in Nuba, what was happening in Darfur, and so do the Northerners. And depending on what those circumstances are, it changes how they negotiate. It is, I think, important that there be some broader attempt to resolve some of the internal national political issues that are leading to the potential dissolution of the country. And one idea I would like to propose here, it's going to be very provocative, just trying to keep everybody awake here, is this, okay? The real problem is no one trusts each other. They don't trust each other. The Northerners don't trust the Southerners. Southerners don't trust the Northerners. I think just in the South's case, for a very good reason. There are very good reasons why the Darfuri rebels do not want to negotiate with the NCP, given the atrocities that were committed on a massive scale in 2003 and 2004, and the massive displacement of population, the burning of 2,700 villages that we now have aerial evidence of. And the thing that really everybody talks about is security. I mean, they talk about development, but they really talk about is security. They don't want to be have a repetition of these atrocities. You know, more 10 times more Southerners died than Darfuris died over the course of the Civil War. People forget that, I think, and that's something that annoys the Southerners a lot. I think the United States, and I can say this now that I'm not in office anymore and there's a new administration coming in, I think the United States should consider, only in the context of a larger political settlement for Sudan, of security guarantees to the rebel groups in Darfur if they sign an agreement after the Southerners. Now, the details of that could be worked out later, and there are many people who would object to this, but I want to say the risk of this is that the Southerners, there is a faction in the South that wants a conflict. They were the people driving the South toward actually invading the North. There is an element in the South. The notion that all the fault is in the part of the North is simply not true. I think 90% of it is, but not all of it is. There are people in the South who want to go back to the war. I've talked to them at length, and they will go through all the arguments. And the notion, if we do propose some sort of a security arrangement in the context of a larger political settlement that everybody agrees to, makes sense only if it's not constructed in a way that empowers those forces in the South or in Darfur that wish a dissolution of the state or a breakup of Sudan, or who that want to go back to conflict. So those are my general observations. I would just say that there are three quick things that the Obama administration needs to consider. One is we have a fixed period of time here before the 2011 referendum. Every month counts. And my observation is Somalia fell apart the first 6 months of 1993 because no one was in charge during the transition. This is true of all presidents. It has nothing to do with party. When, because of the convoluted process of putting people in office in new governments in this country, there's always a vacuum, power vacuum. Hillary Clinton may be the only Obama administration official in the State Department for 3 or 4 months, or maybe even longer than that. It's a very dangerous situation. Having an envoy in place or someone in a senior position who has the ear of the President of the United States and the Secretary of State to push along these issues in conjunction with our allies in Europe and the United Nations and the EU is absolutely essential. Having one plan that all of us work on together is also essential. The Sudanese government loves having multiple plans that they can play different factions across from each other. When they don't like one, they support another. And they love chaos because it actually allows for more delays. And we shouldn't give them that benefit. I am told that the AU-UN envoy is doing a very good job and is moving toward some kind of a plan for dealing with the Darfur issues, and I think there should be unified support for that plan so long as it looks realistic and that it might work. And if the rebels are not particularly cooperative in this, there needs to be efforts to send messages, very strong messages, to the rebels who refuse to participate in the peace process. I want to commend JEM for going to Doha. It was a constructive thing to do. There are certain other leaders, one of whom is in Paris, the cafe still, who is refusing to participate as he did when I was there. I don't think he'll ever go to a peace conference, and I think we should sort of forget about him. There should be an effort to support other four leaders in Darfur who can take up the leadership because the leadership has been such a terrible failure as it is constructed now. So I think feeling that period in the first few months of this year is very, very important. I would add that while we all talk about what we can do, there are limits to what outsiders can do, I think. Limits. We should work, we should try, but one of the things that lets the Sudanese get off is when they say, well, it's up to you guys outside to fix this. It's not up to the outsiders to fix this. We can try. We can try to make the regional players who are neighbors of Sudan, who have a huge amount to say about what happens in Darfur, for example. Without the neighbors, any plan in Darfur will not work. That is to say, Libya, Chad, Egypt, and Eritrea. They have a lot to say about what happens in Darfur, and to some degree, even with the North-South thing. If they're not involved in this and they're excluded, it will not work. But They have to fix their own problem. Our job is to support that process and sort of push them in a constructive way toward those ends. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And thank you, Eddie, for such an excellent report. I think it really is a first-rate piece of work. Timetables. We've heard a lot about timetables. I had the pleasure of living in Darfur in the 1980s at the end of the Sudan Railway Terminus, where we had the world's most simple, elegant timetable, which was the train for Khartoum will leave Monday sharp. And it always did leave Monday sharp, but when it arrived in Khartoum was a matter of complete conjecture. It could take 2 days, it could take a week, it could take even longer. It went on a very long trip, an impressively long trip, but the time when it actually arrived at the other end was never according to any timetable. And I think that's, think Sudan Railways when you think timetables. And I want to come back to that. The CPA asked Sudan to do two things, two fundamental things, either one of which would have been hugely challenging for a poor, ill-governed country emerging from conflict. One was the exercise of the right of self-determination for the people of South Sudan. The other was the democratic transformation of the entire country. When the CPA was signed, those who had been involved in the negotiation said, we've got 10% of the way there. The next 6 years is the 90%. And this requires concerted, focused effort. And sadly, that concerted, focused effort has not been there for all sorts of reasons, due partly to the untimely death of Dr. John Garang, due to the Darfur crisis, et cetera, et cetera. And so we're at the stage where two-thirds of the way through, we haven't done one-third of the work, I would say. Now, these two tasks are intrinsically linked, the task of democratization and the task of the right of self-determination. And the reason why they're linked is that if the right of self-determination is not exercised in an orderly and consensual way, there will be a war. I completely subscribe to what Andrew said, that the majority of the southern population will vote for separation if they have the chance. I cannot think of an example in which there has been a contested partition, a partition of a country that has been undertaken under conditions of less than legitimacy of the authorities in both parts of the country, that has gone off without serious violence. And we know the implications of that. We talk about having 2 years to go before the referendum. In fact, really, we have less than that, because the moment that the referendum becomes the major fact on the political horizon, which is pretty much what will happen as soon as a new government of national unity is constituted after the elections, the parties will be calculating accordingly, and both sides will have, especially the North, will have reasons for leaving issues unresolved so that they have cards in their hand afterwards. So there's a huge amount of work to be done in a very short period of time. And the Sudanese political system works at a certain pace. It's very, very hard to accelerate it. It would be impossible to run an Asella express train along the line from Niala without it getting derailed pretty much immediately. And I think that's a reality that we need to look at. It functions at a certain pace in the formal sense, passing legislation through the National Assembly, resolving all the technical issues that need to be done before an election can be held, et cetera, et cetera. It also works at a certain pace in the informal way, beneath the surface. The real deal of the CPA was not just what was in the paper that was signed in Nairobi 4 years ago. It was an understanding, a personal understanding between the late Dr. John Garang and Vice President Ali Osman Taha. And a lot of that has to do with resources. It has to do with money. And beneath the formalities of the surface, a lot of the way that Sudan operates is as a political marketplace. It is the delivery of suitcases full of money to provincial leaders, to militia leaders, etc., to buy them off, to buy their loyalty. There is an auction of loyalties. And the skill of the Sudanese politicians who run this at the center, most notably in Khartoum, but also in Juba, is getting the price right. and they resent the involvement of people like ourselves because we tend to inflate the price of loyalty in the peripheries, particularly in Darfur. And they don't want to pay what they see as more than the real market rate for people like Abdul Wahid al-Nour or Mini Minawi. It sticks in their gullet to pay these people more than they consider that they are worth. They think this is actually a speculative bubble and that we will tire and withdraw and then they can pick them up much more cheaply. That's really the calculation. So getting to these deals also takes time. It also cannot be hurried. It can be done more quickly, more expeditiously. But doing it more quickly and expeditiously requires there to be more money around. And there are two things that are slowing down this train at the moment. One is the ICC. The ICC is becoming the almost exclusive focus of political activity and energy, especially in Khartoum. And my great fear about the ICC effect is less that the Sudan government is going to lash out, to expel the UN, to expel international diplomats, to go to war, anything like that, but it's simply going to slow down this already slow-moving train, bring it to a halt, and make it very, very very, very difficult for all the other things that need to be done to be done. And it's going to impede the ability of international diplomats to engage with the president of Sudan if he is under arrest warrant. Will it be possible for Sir Derek to actually go and meet with a man whom the International Criminal Court has said should be arrested? I don't know. And the other thing that's going to slow it down is the financial crisis. The budget that was passed about 6 or 7 weeks ago in the National Assembly was less than 50% of the previous budget. So there's less money around. And we will see the repercussions of that in terms of local militia leaders becoming more aggressive, more demanding of their money. So there's a desperately short amount of time with a train that is slowing down to get to a destination that is really quite a long way away. And should it fail to get there, should we move into the period when there is this referendum, and I think if the referendum is held, the outcome is pretty much a foregone conclusion, get to a point at which Sudan is facing a partition without the issues having been resolved, without the legitimacy, proper legitimacy being bestowed upon the governments north and south through a proper electoral process, and indeed the ICC itself may erode the legitimacy to such an extent that there are powerful groups in the north, like Turabi's party, for example, that are the greatest supporters of the ICC, that say the government that has presided over the partition of the country is not legitimate, and we don't accept that, and we're going to contest it. So what I would advocate, and I think it's a very difficult thing to achieve, particularly at this moment, is a very single-minded focus on getting the job done such that there can be an orderly and consensual exercise of the right of self-determination. And everything else, the ICC, the Darfur issue, whatever other issues may arise, has to be made secondary and has to be made supportive of achieving that. Even then, I think it's uncertain whether we have enough time to achieve what is necessary in the few months that are remaining.
Thank you. Thank you all for really excellent presentations and a lot to think about. I think we'll open up to the floor, and because there are so many people here, I'll take a few questions at once and then turn back to the panel, maybe four questions to begin with. One thing, Ambassador Natsios, that you talked about was getting the international community on the same page and focus around the same roadmap. And I wonder, China, particularly in the North-South agreement, has not been very outspoken on this. It's hard to draw them out on what their calculations might be. And, in fact, their stake in the North-South referendum is quite high. And we'll go with an additional round of questions, but I wonder how the panelists see rallying a certain amount of consensus when there are such deep divisions within the international community over Darfur, but also the broader Sudan issue. I'm going to stand up. Apologies if I don't recognize you. I left my glasses upstairs. So let's take some questions. We have Steve Morrison in the very back. I did recognize him.
Thank you. Excellent presentations. We're expecting action by the incoming administration on the no-fly zone. What's the implications going to be of that?
Thank you, Steve. Yes. And if you could identify yourself.
My name is Salah. I'm from Sudan Embassy. I just do agree with all the challenges and obstacles have been raised. But I think the CPA itself has a mechanism to deal with these things. We have seen this several times through ABA and the others. The challenge now for the CPA, I think, personally, I think, is the ICC. And this is going to impede the implementation in a very drastic way. There is a recognition inside Sudan that this is going to have a great impact on not on the CPA itself, but on the future of the country itself. The fact that the Vice President Salva Kiir is the head of the High Commission in Sudan concerning this matter, with the shadows of Darfur and all these things. I just have a question about the impact of the ICC. Professor Alex has highlighted some. Professor Natis also has proposed that international engagement Sudan. How is the ICC going to not only impede the implementation of the CPA, but impede the capacity of international community to deal with Sudan positively? The previous administration also has contributed to this, in a sense. After the implementation of the CPA, none of the high official Sudanese have visited Washington. On the other side, one part of the signatories to the CPA have visited here at least 3 or 4 times. Is this going to continue with the current, the coming administration? I hope not, because this has also impeded the influence of the United States to positively influence the political process in Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you. We have a very timid audience today. Okay, well, why don't we start with those, and you can ruminate. And we have another? Yes.
I'm Marie Bazanson, and I have a question for Ambassador Natsios. Could you clarify a bit some of your ideas on the security sector reform and guarantees for the rebels and the Southerners?
Who would like to? Well, should we start with Edward? Hit you first.
Rallying consensus within the international community, is that a question? Sorry, rallying. You started with a question about rallying consensus, where there are so many divisions within the international community, and the role of China in the coming period. There are a lot of challenges to that, but I think that multilateralism was one of the tricks that made the CPA happen, and I think it's something which the current administration has said that it wants to see. The new administration rather has said it would like to see as a the starting point for its diplomacy. I think also that it was very interesting to see the way that the Chinese envoy in Khartoum a few weeks ago phrased his country's position on things like the ICC, where they were giving quite a lot of rhetorical support to the government, but not apparently prepared to commit diplomatic resources to a deferral of the prosecution. So I'm not a China expert at all, but my understanding is that there is more of a recognition that they need to take in on board peace and security questions in their dealings with African countries and Sudan in particular. So I think that a consensus approach would be a very important one. I don't know how realistic, how likely that's going to be. I certainly would hope that the new administration would be able to address that. a no-fly zone and the implications of a no-fly zone. I think it's one of a number of measures. There will be some, presumably some symbolic measures from the United States to mark the change of administration. And Sudan is in some respects an unfortunate country because it has entered domestic US politics, and it's not very good for you if you're a foreign country to be part of domestic debates. I believe it was one that that Hillary Clinton mentioned, one of the possible approaches to Sudan. What I feel is I'm not sure if I could tease out the military implications of a no-fly zone in Darfur. It would have a number of negative consequences. It's a huge area. I don't think it would be like the no-fly zone in northern Iraq because there would still be action on the ground, and the no-fly zone might confuse and prolong the action, the fighting on the ground, rather than ending it. What I would say about any of the choices for the symbolic gesture or the symbolic measure that's coming up to mark a new administration taking power is that they should support this. It should be something that will help the CPA work itself out. It should be something that supports the principles underlying the CPA of a fairer Sudan. I don't know what measure that would be. It will be a different, difficult one to craft. But if those principles aren't honoured, and also if the institutions and processes of the CPA are weakened severely by these new measures, I think that would be a damaging. That would contain a lot of damaging outcomes for Sudan. The impact of the ICC. And that the way that impedes the capacity of the international community to deal with this Sudan positively. Yeah, well, all the Western diplomats certainly that I talked to were tearing their hair out about the ICC. It's kind of upended all of their incentives and threats and all the normal diplomatic chips and that they have. And I'm sure it makes life very difficult for officials. At the same time, it's worth noting that it's probably given the NCP a strong incentive to seek domestic alliances, and I think that is a very important process. And if those alliances turn out to be strong ones that are oriented towards positive change in Sudan, I think that there may be some, it may help Sudan work itself out. It's not going to help. I think you're right, Mr. Salah, in saying that it's going to make it will impede the capacity of the international community to deal day to day with Sudan in a positive way. I think that there's no doubt about that. But I think Sudan is a very volatile country, and the ICC has dropped a great big new dollop of volatility into the country. I think that crises like this do offer some positive potential, as well as making us all feel confused and pessimistic sometimes. On security sector reform, that's for you.
And maybe, Sir Derek, do you want to talk about the China's role? Is that some? Do you engage with the Chinese in terms of the implementation of the CPA?
It's true, and the AEC is a grouping which draws together. The AEC is a grouping which draws together countries which were particularly influential in the Naivasha process. But the totality of countries that can be useful and effective in support of peace in Sudan goes way beyond that. And I think that our governments, the government which I used to work for before I'm doing what I'm doing now, both directly and the government in the United States. New U.S. administration should be looking at constructing effective coalitions in support of the peace processes we have been talking about, but very specifically in support of the CPA. And you need to reach out
and try to find a common view. And in the case of support for the CPA and the implementation of the various steps seen in the CPA, my own experience is that you wouldn't have great difficulty in enlisting the support of the Chinese. They are sympathetic and, broadly speaking, on the same tack as other members of the international community. There are ideas in Edward's excellent report for raising the level of international support for the CPA and its implementation in the coming 2 years. And I think, if the squalls that have been identified as sitting on the horizon at the present moment can be navigated successfully, you could see the case for higher-level ministerial engagement, for compacts or gatherings or whatever in support of this, not, I would stress, in Ambassador Natsios is the sense that he's trying to point us away from, of forcing the Sudanese to do what they don't want to do, because that will frankly never work. I agree absolutely. I mean, what we're talking about here is encouraging people to proceed on a path which they've already effectively agreed and to move down through the remaining steps. And moving on from the sort of, the mobility generally to trains in particular, I mean, I think there is a real risk in the scenario which implies that you have elastic time for all of this. I mean, I agree that the agreement has already demonstrated that it's very difficult to stick to deadlines, but I think the overall time frame is a real one, and what happens if you can't get up sufficient speed is effectively that bits and pieces, that you have to take decisions about what is really essential as you move forward. And I would agree with Ambassador Natsios strongly that actually a focus on the three areas and getting things right there is absolutely essential if we are to move forward within the time frame identified. But I don't think you can seriously question, or we shouldn't actually seriously question the terminal date, so to speak. I think it's there and it needs to be worked through and to.
And Ambassador Natsios, do you want to explain security guarantees? And
Let me also make a comment on the Chinese. The thing that upset the Sudanese more than anything I did in the year and quarter I was envoys when I went to Beijing and we made a joint announcement that we were going to work together on what was happening in Sudan. The reaction in Khartoum was extreme, was much more extreme than anything else I did. So I realized if it looked like the United States and the Chinese were cooperating with each other, that was a huge pressure on the Sudanese government. It was not a threat. It was just, it's their closest ally, and if they looked like they were working with the United States, then it did put pressure on them in a diplomatic way without making any threats. So I have argued that get constantly pounding the Chinese publicly, it might be nice for the advocacy groups. I don't think it's very useful diplomatically. I think it's counterproductive. And I have to say, if you carefully look at what the Chinese have done, they have moved. Maybe not at the pace we want, but their foreign policy, we're not going to transform their foreign policy to be what our foreign policy is. It's China. It's not the United States. They have used rhetoric they have never used in any other country in the world. They've criticized the Sudanese government, which they hadn't done before. More importantly, the most significant thing that's happened with the Chinese is that Salva Kiir himself, something I told him he should do, went to see President Hu and told President Hu that most of the oil was in the south and that since the Chinese government had been neglecting the south, the southerners were very angry and thought that the Chinese were funding the northern army, which could be attacking the south. I'm not going to go through all the details of what happened at that meeting, but it was quite disturbing for the Chinese leadership to hear what Salva Kiir said. There was a huge shift in Chinese behavior with respect to the South after that meeting, and there has been a consistent policy of greater engagement, greater investment in the South, more loans, more aid, and a much greater sensitivity to the opinions of Salva Kiir and his government in the South. So the most important thing that happened with the Chinese was not done by outsiders. It's done by the Southerners. And I think that's a lesson that we ought to learn, that the Southerners have a much bigger card in all of this to play than we do, since the oil's on their property, and that's one of the major reasons the Chinese, even though they won't say it, are engaged in this, they're worried about oil supplies in the future. In terms of security sector reform, it occurred to me that if all else failed in terms of diplomacy, one thing that could restrain a potential war was the improvement in the organizational capacity and training of the SPLS. So I spent a large amount of my time on that issue. I don't want to go through all the details. If I have to write a book about it, I will go through all the things we did. We didn't do a lot of it publicly. The Southerners, of course, knew about it because we were working with them. And there is an $80 million, it's public, it's not a secret, $80 million program. It's been substantially increased each year for the last 4 years of non-lethal assistance to the South. This is a matter of reforming the SPLA so it becomes a formal, instead of a guerrilla organization, which is what it was, everybody admits that, into a formal military hierarchy. And subordinated to civilian rule. It's very important, subordinated to civilian rule. I'm not going to go into all the details of it. It's not a secret, but I think it's very important. I think it's important that we not provide weapons because there are people in the South who actually have told me we want the weapons so we can attack the North. We do not want to do that. The one weapon that I think we should provide is an air defense system. I don't think the North will ever invade the South again. If they do, they'll get creamed because the Southern infantry is much more powerful than the Northern infantry is. And I don't want to go into all of the details of the balance of power, but there's a huge arms race going on. I'm not sure it's very healthy at this point, but an air defense system for the United States could not be used for offensive purposes by the South. It could only be used to defend themselves. But what I said about a security sector, security guarantee is not with respect to the security improvements in the Southern, in the SPLA. It is a guarantee we would make to protect the South and the Darfuris should there be a renewal of massive atrocities against either area. Should they sign a peace agreement? And should the Darfuri rebels and the Southerners implement it along with the government? This cannot be entirely one-sided. If we simply say this is directed against the North, it's not going to work very well. So I think that's something that would actually change the calculus in the negotiations, make them more serious. And whether the administration is willing to do that on others is another matter.
Alex, you want to talk about the no-fly zone?
I just wanted to say one thing about the international consensus. Don't overlook Russia. The Russians are moving in an aggressive way, both economically and diplomatically. And I would expect that in the coming years, Russia will actually be the one that stands up for Sudan in the Security Council and so on, rather than China. The no-fly zone is what I think the best-case scenario would be an expensive irrelevance. The worst-case scenario is it will sufficiently deepen distrust and escalate confrontation, including worsening the humanitarian situation by having retaliatory actions from the part of the Sudan government in terms of humanitarian access and so on. So I think it would be a foolish thing to do.
Yeah, we have a question there.
Hi, thank you very much. Philippe DuPonte from Eurasia Group. So assuming that Khartoum is unable to make unity attractive enough heading into 2011, which seems to be the assumption of some people, then switching that around, what can be done to ensure that partition or whatever you want to call it is acceptable to Khartoum, something they can live with? Ambassador Natsios seemed to suggest some continuation of revenue sharing on the oil. But I'd be interested to hear a scenario on how that happens. Thanks.
We had a question here.
Thanks, gentlemen, for your illuminating discussion. My name's Nitha with the National Endowment for Democracy. I'm going to put my head on the line and disagree with Ambassador Natsios. I think that, in my personal opinion, I'm only 24 years old, but I think that one person to negotiate peace amongst the movements in Darfur is irrelevant. I think it's not about who negotiates or how many people. It's about what they're negotiating. I think it would be interesting to see, and this is sort of my question, would it be interesting to come up with a plan for transitioning to peace for the NCP so that they don't feel like they're in a lose-lose situation and provide more options to them in the coming year? And also, I wanted to know your general comments on the Qatari initiative as a possible potential avenue for peace.
Yes, back in the back again.
Well, Lawrence Freeman from Executive Intelligence Review. Everyone's probably aware that last month in December there was an article in the New York Times, an op-ed by a columnist, Christoph, that discussed a memo allegedly from the special envoy Williamson Now, which was handed to Obama, which advocated very serious military escalation, taking out helicopters, planes, blockading the port. So this seems to me to be setting up the new Obama administration to take military action, which this administration has not taken. What would be behind this? And how do you view this as a dangerous misdirection for this new administration about 6 days away to be fall into a pitfall in war in Sudan?
We have one in the way back there.
I'm Ian Collard from the British Embassy. I'm just wondering, secession has been touted by our panelists as being a likely outcome of a referendum, and I'm just wondering how viable will a state of southern Sudan or whatever it's called after secession actually be?
Okay, let's turn back with that round. How to make a potential split palatable? Sir Derek, do you want to the north?
Yep. I mean, I don't know how useful it is to go into the detail of how oil produced in the south or in the Abyei region, for example, might progressively be shared post 2011 and what arrangements there might be, but that would be a likely element in any sort of post 2011 arrangement goes without saying, for reasons which I mentioned in my presentation and Ambassador Natsios elaborated on. I mean, I think all of us, it seems to me, were pointing in a particular direction there. That is, that there is a need not for a sort of framework to be imposed upon the Sudanese parties, but that it is important that a discussion develop between them as to what might be the situation post 2011. And there are other things that they would need to talk through too. I mean, they need also to talk about their priorities in respect of unity, but they need to look at what might happen in the event of secession, and they need to look at things like citizenship and the nature of the border and so on. All these things would need to be explored. I don't think it's one of those areas where you can't say this is the scenario or this is how they should go, but that there is a need for that discussion to take place seems to me to be self-evident. I think that's very...
Any of the other questions you want to tackle?
I think, again, I would underline, you know, a second time. In answer to Ian Collard's question about the viability of the South, I mean, I think, you know, the South has changed over the past 3 or 4 years in terms of putting institutions in place. In a sense, you know, those are the questions they need to ask themselves about how sustainable future arrangements there might be in the context of secession. But that they have the right to make that choice, I think, goes without saying. No, I'll stop on that.
Let's see. On the kind of the military option or the more aggressive rhetoric and so forth, I mean... Edward, you talked about pressures on Khartoum reaching a point to which, you know, they feel forced to build coalitions within Khartoum. But I imagine it's a careful balance between pressures that encourage coalition versus pressures that cause hunkering down or retrenching. And I wonder, do you want to respond to the to that aspect?
Well, I'm not a military expert, and I'm not sure what each of this menu of options would achieve or whether there's much predictability about what each of the... I did read the article. I think it's like destroying the Air Force or no-fly zone and Port Sudan, blocking Port Sudan. I mean, there's a lot of unpredictability. There's always a lot of unpredictability in Sudan. There's extra unpredictability this year. Whether a little bit more would necessarily lead to a better resolution of things. Right now, I'm not sure. I mean, I think, and the other panelists have talked about the really great importance of trying to stick to some of the current processes and not detract from them. What I said before, that whatever measures are taken to mark the new approach to Sudan, I think putting the CPA's processes and institutions first is very important.
And Ambassador Natsios, do you want to respond to Nitha's question?
To what?
To Nitha.
Oh, yes, yes. Let me make a comment. Senator Obama ran with the support of a lot of advocacy groups on Sudan. And Dr. Thomas is correct that when you get any foreign issue involved in domestic politics, it complicates it. And this more than almost, I haven't seen an issue in our history, actually, like this, that's mobilized people in rural areas. If you go to rural Maine, you see Save Darfur signs up. So they have mobilized the country. And now the mobilization is unclear as to what it's supposed to be doing. The talk about military intervention, when you talk about the military, you have to connect it to some kind of something you want them to do. They haven't done that. But what people are saying, we need to inflict more pain. Now, I believe in inflicting pain, you know, in certain circumstances. If the atrocities of 2003 or 4 were going on, you could make the argument. But you can't make these claims or make these proposals detached from what's happening in Darfur now. The number of people dying a month in Darfur right now is maybe 100, maybe 150. At the maximum, 200 people are dying a month. That is not what happened in 2003 and 4. 96% of all the people who died in Darfur died the first 2 years. We are at a low-scale insurgency right now. The rebels, one of the rebel groups, had intended to attack two of the capital cities and bring the war into the capital city. The Sudanese government reacted by attacking the rebel emplacements. I mean, do we really want to get involved in the middle of that? It's one thing if the Sudanese government went in and started bombing the displaced camps and massacring the population. In my view, we would intervene from the air militarily. I would support that. Otherwise, I don't know what all this loose talk is. What is it that the military intervention is going to force? If you blockade Port Sudan, what is it you're trying to elicit from them that's different than what they're doing now? You think you're going to force them into signing a peace agreement that over the next 5 years they're going to carry out that they signed under duress with a blockade at their port? That's why I think we should go back to what their interests are and what will stabilize the country as opposed to these other. If the situation changes, if the North sends 100,000 troops into the South and starts slaughtering people in mass, bombing the cities, that's a different matter. Then these options are a real possibility. But we're not there. There are 13,000 aid workers right now providing support to 2.5 million people. They're all. What do you think is going to happen to all those people if we start taking some of these military measures? You think the Sudanese? You know what? We know what the Sudanese do when they're under stress. I can go through the three major external pressures in the Sudanese government. When they shut off, when we the president imposed, and I helped design it. I helped design it, so I'm part of this. Much more aggressive sanctions against the Sudanese government. Within 3 months, they took action. They did take action. They responded. The first thing is they shut off oil revenues to the south for a month, and it caused chaos in the southern finances. That's what they did. That was the first thing they did. The second thing is there were orders we know from intelligence to withdraw all troops from the south, according to the CPA, into the north. They had their orders in hand. President Bashir, as a result of these sanctions, ordered everyone to stay in place and not leave. So they got a response. It was the exact opposite response than what we intended. When the divestiture bill went through, and I supported these measures personally, privately, until I realized what effect they were having. We need to look at the effect of the things those of us from outside are doing have on inside the country. Three things took place when the divestiture, within 2 weeks, a Foreign Service officer of AID was assassinated in Khartoum. Two, an invasion of Chad took place, and they almost unseated the Deby government. The worst bombing of villages, of civilian areas, took place within 2 weeks of the divestiture bill being signed by the president. And then there was a fourth thing. I can't remember what it was. If you look at their reaction, it's the exact opposite of what we intend. So I think we should be very careful. And what did they do after the ICC indictments? They started torturing people and arresting people, and there was more repression. We need to look at what we're proposing's consequences inside the country. If they have the right consequences, then we should consider them. But that's not what's been happening if you look objectively at the sequence of events. In terms of the negotiations, I was at the negotiations. I know what happened. The rebel groups tried to outbid each other for demands in the agreement. And every time
Abdelwahid Nour would say he wants this. Jem would say, no, I want more. I want higher reparations. I want more seats. They were outbidding each other to be more extreme to appeal to people in the camps. Now, the second thing that happened during the negotiations is the Sudanese government, they pay off people in the negotiations. They all get paid off. We know there are very amusing stories that I will not mention in public as to how far they went in paying people off. So what they do is Alex said this. I think you all thought he was joking. He's not joking. When there's disorder in the cities in Darfur, Saleh Ghosh, the head of the internal security, sends in people with bags of money, and they pass it out to people who are causing trouble, whoever they are, and say, leave within 24 hours and we'll give you money. If you don't leave, we're not giving you the money. That's how they calm people down when there's conflicts. They don't always use weapons. Frequently they do, but they pay people off. The more factions, the more they will simply bid up the cost of doing the negotiations, the more the rebels will bid up what they're demanding, and they'll never get to a resolution of this. The idea of any negotiation is to reach a conclusion that everybody can sign on. The rebels, by the way, all hate each other as much as they hate the Sudanese government, and they are killing each other, I might add. The Arab tribes are killing each other now. Half the deaths in 2007, my last year in office, were Arabs killing Arabs trying to steal the land of the African tribes that were in the displaced camps, the Four, the Mazalit, and the Zaghawa. So you can have the negotiations if you want to. I try to do it in Libya with the UN and the Europeans and everyone else. I did all my part, and I watched what happened. And my conclusion is you can do it. It'll look good. It'll be good in the newspaper. We can write our reports on it. We will have no peace agreement.
Thanks.
Just picking up on what Andrew said, I was with Abdelwahid had breakfast with him on the morning when he was refusing to sign the Darfur peace agreement. And he was telling me all the principled reasons why he was not signing the peace agreement. Then he gets a call on his cell phone, and he's talking in Arabic, saying, 30 million, not enough, but I'd settle for 90. It was a very mercenary negotiation on the side. This marketplace is a real marketplace with supply and demand and the price fluctuating. Two other points. I think it's absolutely essential when you talk about pressure for what. And Sudan is a hugely complicated system, and it is very difficult for it to move. It can move smartly in some in some areas. You can stop aerial bombardment overnight. It's much more difficult for it to move politically. And therefore, asking the Sudanese political system to do something complicated is a challenge. Let's ask it to do some basic things it has already agreed to, and let's make it clear that is what is what's being asked of it. Think of the security mentality of the advisors to the president of Sudan. How does a security officer think, or a military officer? He's trained to think, where is the center of gravity of the threat against us? And if that center of gravity is not clear, they will not come to a decision. It's only when they know and they have come to their own internal decision about what is the ultimate objective of those who are arraigned against them, that they will begin to implement their strategy. Now, why the CPA was negotiated successfully was the confidence that the center of gravity was an understanding, bringing the SPLM into government, as a result of which Sudan will be normalized, a clear outcome. The last couple of years, there's been no such clarity. And those within the Sudan government who believe that the center of gravity, the ultimate agenda that is coming, is one of regime change, tend to have the upper hand in that uncertainty. And if they have the upper hand, we're not going to get anywhere. So that's why the processes that have been described around the CPA and having utter, complete clarity around that is so essential. Any coercive measures, any pressure, must be ancillary, supportive of that. If it's trying to do something else, it is going to create confusion. It is going to create a fog. It is going to slow everything down. And my last point would be, in response to the question about how viable is a state in South Sudan, it's going to be a challenge. But the key question about the viability of the state in South Sudan is how it comes into being. If it comes into being in an orderly, consensual way, with the acquiescence, support, collaboration of the North, that after all controls the oil pipeline and therefore 90-something percent of the revenue that goes to the South, it is a viable state. If it comes into being in any other way, I don't think it's going to be viable for a very long time.
Thank you all. We have a time for one more round of questions. One in the way back. Gentleman here up front. And the gentleman over here.
Thank you. My name is Ahmed Hussein. I'm from GEM. I would like to comment on the issue of the reduction of killing in Darfur. If there is any reduction on that one, that because, you know, they wipe out all the villages and they don't have anything, you know, to do or to go against or something like that, because they wipe all the villages in Darfur, in Western Darfur, and that kind of thing. The other thing also about the fragmentation of tribes, that, you know, being a lot of myth about that one, because there is a lot of exaggeration saying that a lot of factions are rebels. If I ask Andronasius right now how you define movements and what are the criteria for that one, there is no answer for that. Because when you met Eliasson and all these mediators, you ask them, do you have criteria what constitute or how do you define the rebel movement or faction? They don't have. Yes, because sometimes they are very lazy and they just want to find excuse to say that we cannot push the government far more or something. That's why we have, you know, a lot, because we have a lot of fragmentation in the rebels or something like that. Just because they want to find excuse for that. The other thing also, the issue of the ICC. I think the international community has been engaging the government of Sudan for a long time. But what we get is there is no implementation of the CPA. I don't think that the CPA now is better off without the ICC. We cannot see even the DPA, which we signed with Minim, now is implemented. We cannot see any kind of breakthrough or something like that. So I don't think that the ICC is going to impede the process of implementation of the CPA or something like that. As a matter of fact, it's going to be good and best for the long-term kind of change, actually, in our country, and that for sure, because I do think that the National Congress is going to measure its response to the indictment of the ICC, because a lot of them, they enjoy power and they don't want to commit suicide. For that, they are going to observe, you know, and they are going to take measure wisely so that not to commit suicide or to make anything which might make others react negatively against them, because they want to stay in power. Thank you.
Thank you. Up front here.
I'm Martin McMahon, managing partner of an international law firm, and first of all, I want to say it's been a great discussion. I appreciate the former ambassador's comments very much. My question to the panel is, can anybody speak to the potential influence and perhaps financial support that a country like Libya can contribute to, especially since Libya now is sort of our friend, I guess, today? If anybody can speak to that. I had a question, too, about the criminal proceeding. In the practice of law, we put those proceedings on hold if they're, you know, potentially disruptive of some larger process, and I wonder why you can't just put that ICC proceeding on hold. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have one here, and then we have a final one over there, or maybe we can squeeze one more in.
Hello, my name is Nate Haken. I'm from the Fund for Peace, and my question is, should there be a destabilized Sudan, what might the spillover effects be in the neighboring countries, specifically Uganda?
Thanks. And then we have one up here. Robert, then second row.
I'm Vivek Srivastava from the World Bank. Thank you very much for the presentation. My question is, you know, trying to think about the next couple of years towards going towards the referendum, and on the issue of sort of the pace and the selectivity on the implementation of the CPA. I guess when the CPA was signed and, you know, the interim period was put into place, there was some thinking that the outcome at the end of this was not well known, or there was, you know, there was some possibility that it could go either way. And therefore, the expectations we would have in the interim period on, particularly on democratic transformation and issues like that, you know, would be guided by that. But now, if, you know, people in this room certainly think, and there are many others, that the outcome is inevitable, and if that's known to people here and the players on the ground, then how does it influence the behaviors now, and in particular the implementation of the CPA going from now to the referendum?
Very good question. Okay, let's squeeze one more in, and then we'll turn just for wrap-up answers and kind of final comments from the panel.
Thank you. Dan Griffin with Catholic Relief Services. I'm going to keep it very short. The panel has talked about the need to strike out with a quick consensus among the outside actors relating to Sudan. But given the events in Gaza, is that even possible to bring Libya, Egypt, on board? And secondly, when you mentioned oil, but what about water as a resource? How long can Egypt stay out of a possibly dissolving Sudan?
Thrown in at the end there. Okay. Okay, let's start with Sir Derek. You can pick off which ones you'd like most like to answer, and any kind of concluding remarks, I think.
Okay, well, I think in terms of the neighboring countries, yes. I mean, my experience, because I visited several of them, Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, in preparation for taking on this job, and two of them at least, Ethiopia and Kenya, are members of the Commission, indeed have upped their representation. Indeed, the international organizations too, the African Union and the Arab League, have upped their representation in recent months. I think there is a sort of a collective sense that this is a moment at which to focus on the CPA and concern about where things might head, and the desire to play more of a part, which is complicated in each of their cases sometimes by their particular relations with one or the other of the parties, but that sense is there. And Egypt has demonstrated its interest recently by the president's visit, President Mubarak's visit, both to Khartoum and to Juba, the latter being a sort of a first, I think, almost for any Arabs to head of state. Or head of state from anywhere. So I think there is a focus, and clearly in the Egyptian case, water is an issue. And I think all of this interest and concern is positive, really. I mean, we were talking earlier about sort of building international coalitions and enlisting the interests of the Russians or the Chinese because they have influence. Well, I think that's this regional interest is potentially important, too. As to, I think the question was about the question about the impact of a focus on the referendum and a presumption about the referendum on politics in the intervening period. Well, I suppose it will take over to some extent, but I think we shouldn't neglect the elections and the importance of the elections. I think the immediate focus of everybody, including within the SPLM, where there's not just one view about where the South should go, although, you know, as Ambassador Natsio said, if you go around the South, what you hear is clearly at street level very much one view, but that isn't a united view. And the focus, I think, in the coming months at least, will be, assuming the election date is chosen and people move towards elections, on that. And the rhetoric there and the debate there will be, I think, slightly different. And I think the SPLM has a broader national role to play as well as focusing on this sort of existential issue for them of the referendum subsequently. So I don't think it's yet taken over, but increasingly it will if as the months pass. Thank you.
Thanks. A lot of complicated questions. And I'm not sure I can answer all of them. I think on the sense of inevitability and its impact on politics, I think it's very hard not to feel that separation is going to happen when you speak to people in the South. I mean, if there is a referendum, everybody that you speak to almost wants to vote for secession. I think, though, that both sides have very strong tactical reasons not to discuss that publicly. There's been only one public discussion in Juba, and that was in November this year, of the post-referendum. And it was led, interestingly, by someone called Mansour Khalid, who is a long-standing northern elite member of the SPLM. So he had an interesting perspective on it. I think that the fact that people aren't talking very much about what comes after means that there is still meaning to politics at the moment. And it's also very important that the SPLM continues to offer the possibility of competitive politics in northern Sudan, for northern Sudan, to make the best of these 30 months remaining. I think that northern, in some ways, I agree with what you were saying, that northern Sudan perhaps is in more dire straits than the south is. That the south is moving towards coherence as a political community, and the north isn't at all. And so it's important that some of the ideas that were developed by the SPLM about change in Sudan, which are very attractive to northern dissidents, that they get a proper hearing in this period, and that there's possibilities of civil politics. There's just some memory of the practice of civil politics developed in the next 30 months would be a great resource for the post 2011 period. On the whole, I think the refusal to discuss post 2011 is probably harmful, but it does contain some opportunities. And then the issue about Gaza and the link between Gaza and what's happening in Sudan. I guess it will be difficult to mobilize. It's important to mobilize the Arab world on Sudan. They do play a role in and they are the first port of call very often for the NCP when it's facing a crisis. The fact that Arabs almost universally see a problem of double standards between what's happening in the Palestinian territories and what's happening in Arab countries. It doesn't help that at all. And so solutions in the if you see Sudan as part of a greater Middle East as well as part of Africa, solutions in the greater Middle East will have payoffs for Sudan, I would think.
Ambassador.
With respect to the neighbors, you said Uganda, but let me speak generally. Many of the neighbors are preparing for the dissolution of Sudan. They are making military contingencies to seal the border because of the potential for movement of populations which they don't want across their border. So they are very nervous. I'm not going to tell you which countries are doing what because it'll compromise my conversations with heads of state that I've known for many years. So they are very alarmed by all this. They don't want it to happen. If you are specifically speaking about Kony and his little lunatic fringe there, Kony is reestablishing his army now in the Congo for a new round of atrocities. You know what he's doing. I'm sure you've heard the stories. I am very concerned about that. And the Sudanese government, you know, if they feel threatened enough, they're not, so far as I know, they're not helping him or subsidizing. They were before. The last thing on earth we want them is arming them again and, you know, encouraging them or supporting them. Right now, they don't have any outside support, so far as I could tell when I was in office. I don't think things have changed in the last year. So there are risks. There are risks because these borders are porous. You know, I was in Darfur on the border with Chad, and I was walking around, and they said, you know, you're in Chad now. I said, how do you know? This is just dirt. There's no post there. There's no fence. There's no road. So the borders are completely porous. Many of the tribes move back and forth constantly across the borders. But the president, President Deby of Chad, is a Zagawa. He's a Zagawa. All of the greatest Mazalite and the four commanders, but the military forces in Darfur right now in the north are all Zagawa. So the notion that we can do this, and he didn't support the Zagawa initially, and there was an attempt by his brothers to unseat him because he was not supporting the Zagawa rebels in Darfur. So whatever Deby does, he's going to cause problems for either side. And he tried to remain neutral. That did not work very well. And the Sudanese twice have tried to overthrow him. Eritrea and Libya, I have to use this carefully without, you know, compromising my conversations with them, have substantial operational influence on what happens inside Darfur, and it is not diplomatic. substantial, far more than anyone in the UN or the AU or the European Union or the United States, because they see it for different reasons. It took me a long time to understand what the hell the Eritreans were doing in Darfur, but I finally got all the, my friends who were heads of state explained it to me. It took me a long time to understand it as a naive American, but I get it now. The Libyans are close by. You can understand why they're concerned about what happens in Darfur. If you do not take into account their interests, they will find a way of making sure the peace agreements don't work. The Sudanese government knows that. The rebels know it, and the southerners know it. Why it's taken so long for the international community to understand that, I don't know. It took me a while, but I kind of get it all now. It just took a while. It's complicated. To answer the question here, the vote will not make the South independent. The vote has to, as Alex has said several times, be accepted by everyone as legitimate. The vote itself, I mean, we may accept it, but that is not sufficient for the people inside Sudan. There are, you know, former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi has continued to attack the CPA. I met with him and I said, you know, Sadiq, you're continuing to attack it. You're making the Southerners nervous that the Northerners really don't want a peace agreement. Well, Andrew, I have problems with this section of it. I said, well, why don't you say that publicly? Because it's very unclear why you keep attacking it. Tarabi, I met with him, he keeps attacking it too. So it's not unified at all within the Khartoum elite and the Nile River Arabs that they're all going to support this when it happens. So I think Alex is absolutely right. Having elections this year will legitimize the northern government and southern government of some sort. And when the elections, the referendum takes place, then there is legitimacy behind that vote. That is why in the article that I wrote in Foreign Affairs, I said I didn't mention it in my talk when I was doing it extemporaneously, but the referendum is critically important, but the national elections are critically important to make sure that the referendum is seen as legitimate.
Alex.
Thank you. I think if it comes to war, in a new war, most of the neighbors will get involved. And certainly the African Union, African heads of state are absolutely terrified at the prospect of a poorly managed, non-consensual exercise in self-determination. I don't think it's necessarily I don't think it is inevitable that the vote will be for separation, because I think that there are groups within the NCP that are investing considerable resources in trying to buy off not individual voters but buy off elites from the south, and certainly the SPLM as an organisation will face almost unsurmountable problems in deciding whether it's a separatist or unionist, because although there is although the majority is separatist, the unionist minority has a veto over the decisions in the organization, and it has a strong constituency in the north, which would be for whom unity is a matter of life and death. So the issue for the southern political elites is actually really quite complicated and quite difficult, and they, one of the reasons why they are not talking about it is because they haven't resolved the question among themselves, and I think this is really quite fundamental.
I want to thank you all for your patience. I know we've gone a little over time. The new administration coming in is going to face a raft of challenges globally, domestically, and even within Sudan. But the clear message I hear across this panel is to refocus on the centrality of the CPA and focus on the key provisions of the CPA that are going to move us forward here. And I think the challenge for our UN ambassador will be to build consensus on a way forward, listen to our partners, and as Ambassador Natsios, listen to the Sudanese as well. And I just want to say again to the panel, thank you so much for your presentations, for your travel here from far away, and to our audience for sticking with us through this. Thanks.